Well, after many years of being near the MSU campus, on the campus, living in the area, attending school here, and now working here for some number of years, I still can't get over how different this place becomes during the breaks. And between temperatures in the single digits or teens and Christmas break, it is quiet around here. And some number of people, I will have you know, and you know who you are, love it that way. We won't name names. Welcome to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Later this hour, Brian Jeffries, late of the Lansing City Council, and we learn about the Potter Park Zoo's involvement in saving an endangered Puerto Rican amphibian. Interesting story you'll learn more about later this hour. After months of silence, one of the Lansing area's biggest development projects is back in the news. Officials say they're hoping for groundbreaking by late spring for the $125 million Red Cedar Renaissance, formerly the Capitol Gateway. A mixed-use development, the Red Cedar Renaissance will cover about 60 acres at Michigan Avenue in Clippert, straddling Lansing and East Lansing, and city officials and others have said the development could be transformational for one of the key avenues in the city, strengthening the link between the two cities. And to learn more, Current State welcomes one of the two developers of the Red Cedar Renaissance, Ferguson Development's Joel Ferguson. Joel, welcome back.
Good morning.
And along with CEO of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, LEAP, Bob Trezise.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Bob. Joel, you've lined up a new partner for this project. Tell us about Frank Cass and what it took to get him on board.
Years ago, President Clinton put me on the Freddie Mac board, and I ended up meeting John McCoy, who's a Columbus person, and another person we used to go to Vegas together with, Michael Block, and they had a surprise birthday party for him two years ago in Scottsdale, and I was there. And on the second night, I'm sitting at the table at Mike's house, and there's Frank sitting there. And we started talking, and he's expressed an interest in being in Lansing, and we talked a while, and and 6 months later, I called him and said, would you be interested? And he had his own jet, and he flew in here, and we talked, and we shook hands and said, let's partner this together.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done $2.5 billion worth of real estate. He did the Pittsburgh waterfront, did major developments. He has 200 employees. I mean, he's really for real.
Did he have any particular concerns about this project? I mean, how long did you have to talk about this?
He's excited. His wife's on the board of Ohio State University. He felt the location is just super. But he has all these contacts with hotels and restaurants and market rate. And he's a guy who knows what he's doing, very aggressive, and very personable. And we hit it off, and it's kind of crazy because we don't have a document between us except a handshake. And we've moved forward. We both respect each other.
Hmm.
We have mutual friends, and so that's where I found him.
Bob, did you play any role? You didn't play any role in bringing Ferguson Development and the new partner together then?
No, that was all Joel.
As great a reputation as you have of bringing people together, you did not play a role in this.
Well, hopefully what we did was put together the correct vision, because as a region, we've thought more and more, Mark, that we should have the ability to attract developers and investment from really around the world, literally. And so, this is a good sign for us that, again, as we climb onto a national stage as a region, that we can attract this kind of developer. You know, Continental Group is one of the leading development firms in North America. I mean, they led the Pittsburgh revitalization effort. It's called North Shore in their downtown. They're still doing more work in downtown Pittsburgh. They've done tremendous projects in downtown Columbus. They're very familiar with college region kind of atmospheres.
Mm.
They were named Developer of the Year in the whole nation. Frank Cass, the founder, was named the top business person in Pittsburgh out of the top 50. He was number one some years ago. So I'm very pleased that Joel has helped bring this kind of developer to the community. But it's the site that is really doing it.
Yes.
I mean, this is a very, very unique and special site.
Well, it's been a while since this project's been in the news. Joel, remind our listeners what the big pieces of the puzzle are here in terms of housing, retail green space.
I'm one of those people who is absolutely convinced there's a great environment for great market rate housing in this site. I believe that there are so many professionals at MSU in the community. When we treat the environment right here, I believe that our real linchpin is going to be these apartments and townhouses that we're going to be building on a strongly environmentally friendly site.
Will students be?
Students will be there,
but there'll
be some student housing. But the thing that on the entrance way, when you drive into this development, you're going to see a wonderful market rate housing development here that people are going in livable, walkable, with a restaurant, with restaurants, with mixed use.
More than one restaurant?
We plan on for sure. And a hotel that's going to really work with a conference center, that's going to really be a great hotel. You're going to see some other things around this site. But I feel that this linchpin, and I mean, I believe right in our interest way and everything else, I believe there's a strong market here when it's done with quality. And I believe that we can make this really work.
It's the site of a former golf course. Let's talk about the green space involved here, though, too. And I know Ingham County Drain Commissioner Pat Lindemann is closely involved in this project.
Well, it's about 60 acres total, the entire from Michigan Avenue to Red Cedar River shore, if you will, and mark 20 acres right along the river trail itself. Will forever not be developed. That will be a park, that will be a water management system, one in the same. In other words, you could have earthen amphitheater there, you could have all kinds of trails. And fortunately, this developer understands the asset that can be to the successful development overall, that you completely tie the neighborhoods, Michigan State, Frandor, Michigan Avenue, the river trail itself, Red Cedar. You tie it all together in a very walkable, environmentally friendly atmosphere, only enhances the development. Some developers wouldn't understand that, but this particular development team does, and it's going to be critical to the stakeholders that is accomplished.
We're talking with Joel Ferguson of Ferguson Development and Bob Trezise of LEAP about the Red Cedar Renaissance Project. Next, you've got three public design charrettes scheduled for between next month and March. Mr. Cass said last week that these are key to the process. What makes them key to the process?
You know, you just can't come into a community and into a neighborhood and not have shared vision with the people who live there. So it's very important that we all sit down and have a shared vision. Now, and I'm so comfortable with the people there in this community who really want the best for the community to sit down there and we have an input and we sit and work together. And I'm going to tell you this, and Bob Trezise, you know, he's told us early what the vision should be for this site. And we happen to be in total concurrence with him on what we're supposed to be doing and what we see the vision. And we also want to be, besides environmentally friendly, community friendly, and we feel this is really going to work. So I'm eager to sit down there with us, because I'm going to tell you, their input is going to even help make this even better. Okay.
To what extent can charrettes, though, and public input alter the project, though? Is it possible that a charrette and a lot of public input could alter the project in ways that you don't like? Either of you don't like?
I think everyone will see the same thing. When everyone's motive is about quality first, to where the goal is, here's what we want. I used to always, our developments that we've had across the state, I've always told the architects when it came to the state police building or the house office building where you can go across the river and you see that etching and all that, I said, design the buildings how they should be, and I'll tell you if I can't afford to do it this way, okay? So we're not going to start with a budget as opposed to we're going to start with a vision.
Okay.
And that's what we want the community to help give us, is a vision to how they want how they want this development to be. And we'll make it work.
You've been on hold here for some number of months. Was any money lost as a result of the delay?
No.
Public money lost as a result of the delay?
No, definitely not. No public money has been lost. We haven't been just sitting around. We've been working diligently for over the last year, meeting with people, talking about ideas, exploring different options. And we know that our process the entire time was to think about what is best for the site, the city of Lansing, and the entire region, the city of East Lansing, MSU, Frandor, the neighborhoods. And so the process has been an excellent one, and we made the best selection primarily because the Continental Group really seemed to embrace the vision of a village, of more of a high-end village, a mixed-use village, a walkable nature to the site, and had the wherewithal financially to pull it off.
Other developments have been moving ahead, though,
are all good projects.
Was that a concern?
Those are mostly student housing projects, I presume you might be referencing. And the thing is, this site is different than that. The market rate housing is going to play a profound role, as well as the other mixed use. So, I mean, this site is not meant to just be a student housing site. So other student housing projects that have been announced have not fazed me one way or the other.
Townhomes and apartments?
Yeah, there'll be some student housing near the Brody area, but mostly it's going to be market rate utilizing the river.
But townhouses?
Going to see when you drive in is going to be the apartments and townhouses. Listen, there is a market here in this, you know, and there's a market if we have the quality of the units, and the location is wonderful, and especially when we do the environment right. Now people are going to want to live there. I mean, it's got everything they'll want. They have a great location.
I guess my question is, though, because of the delay, are you planning fewer residential units?
Let me tell you something about being a developer. It took me from my time I envisioned the state police building, it took me 8 years. The house office building took me 5 years. That's part of doing business in our business, that everything doesn't happen instantaneously, and we understand that and we work through it. So the delay has not cost us any monies, but it's made us better.
Couple of questions for you, Joel, with your MSU trustee hat on, please. What more, if anything, can be done to stop incidents like last weekend's following the Big Ten championship? Any thoughts on that?
We have to have the continued presence of the police. We have to also aggressively punish those and make examples out of those. And we have to keep educating people that you do a disservice to Michigan State by being hooligans. We can't turn a positive event and positive things here and have us being read and being in national news to where we are burning couches or doing stupid things. But we have to punish those people who we happen to identify and catch.
Can it be argued that the city of East Lansing or MSU was relatively underprepared for what happened Saturday night?
It's some things is just impossible. If someone really wants to act a fool, you know, you just can't. You can be there, but when some people just get so out of hand, and also this fire water, I'm just telling you that people get lathered up and they get to drinking and they lose and then they just feed on each other. So some things you really can't completely handle, but you have to be aggressive, and that we have to have the courts in our university, as far as expelling individuals who were part of this and all that. We have to make individuals know that if you're going to be out there and act a fool, you're going to pay.
There's been confusion and some frustration from MSU fans, football fans, over difficulty getting tickets to the Rose Bowl. Do you know what's going on, and is there anything about that process that may need to change?
First of all, our season ticket holders, we have to recognize them more than the people who have large sums of monies. And so the policy that we had, that everyone who bought season tickets would have a right to buy tickets. That's the basic thing we start with. Of course, individuals who made major contributions after we do that will be next in line.
But it starts with the season ticket
Absolutely.
Holders, and they're entitled to a pair.
Absolutely, that's right. Yeah. And it's a great problem to have, to where we have more demand than tickets. I mean, I wish it wasn't that way, but we've been to some other bowls to where the university actually lost money because our ticket sales were so poor because the excitement wasn't there. And even though we received X number of dollars for the bowl, but after we finished sending the band and everyone else there, that we were there on TV, but we ended up not netting any funds for the university. So this is kind of a problem that we'll work to have next year also. And
was it just determined, though, recently, or has it been in play for a longer time that season ticket holders would be entitled to a pair of tickets?
As we developed this problem, we had an evolution to where everyone could see the same thing, that our priority has to be for certain those people who are helping fill in the stadium year in and year out and have sat here for a long time for this to happen. So we did take care of them.
Detroit TV reporter Ross Jones of WXYZ recently took the board to task for some pretty exorbitant perks, travel, hotels, and the like. Did this come up at Friday's meeting?
No, it didn't.
It did not? You called Jones' report a cheap shot. What made it a cheap shot?
I think when you walk by and you interview, the problem that you have when you're being interviewed by television, since I own two TV stations, that if the reporter has a certain theme they want to develop, and individuals give them answers and show that some of the things where they're coming from doesn't work to their theme, and they edit those things out and just have the discussion strictly on where they're coming from, I said, that's what I mean, a cheap shot. Like, he went over and visited Melly Foster, and when you look at the television, it looks like the interview only happened and she wasn't accommodating in talking to him just on the porch, mm-hmm. Yet she invited him in for a half an hour. But the only thing he showed was her talking through the front door, which gave the impression that he's pushing away and that she didn't have an explanation for some of the things. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. All right. Joel Ferguson of Ferguson Development and the Red Cedar Renaissance. We also want to thank Bob Dreisaitz, Lansing Economic Area Partnership. Thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Since 2008, the state legislature has cut funding for Michigan's 15 public universities by a whopping 32%, the 13th highest in the nation, according to a report issued earlier this year by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. These cuts have forced Michigan's public universities to make up the budget shortfalls in other ways, with a significant portion of the burden placed on students. Our next guest says this current model is unsustainable and threatens to price out middle and lower income students from our state's public higher education system. Mike Bolus is the executive director of the President's Council, State Universities of Michigan, which is the coordinating body for the state's 15 public universities. The council recently commissioned a study to look at the economic impact of the state's universities to help make its case for significant budget increases. Mike is here to tell us more about the study and the state of funding for higher education in Michigan. Mike Bolus, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Why did you commission this study?
Well, we really wanted to impress on our audiences, which is both policymakers and the general public, we are key contributors to job and prosperity across Michigan. And what we found in this report that was done by the Anderson Economic Group, commissioned by the President's Council, which, by the way, is the coordinating body for Michigan's 15 public universities. And what we found is that Michigan's 15 public universities are key employers and economic drivers in the state, responsible for more than 120,000 jobs, and with spending and earnings accounting for $24 billion in economic activity. That rivals the automotive industry, compare with the automotive industry, which is 150,000 jobs in auto manufacturing in Michigan.
And I see Michigan State University, we might as well localize this, MSU spent $466 million, total economic impact, $4.7 billion. What's been cut from universities' budgets over the years, though, because of the reduction in investment.
And it's one of the reasons why we did this. We've had a decade of disinvestment here in Michigan, and state support on a per student basis is down 31.4% since 2001, and 48% when adjusted for inflation. And on average, now Michigan's universities receive about $2,000 less per student state support than universities. In peer states being California, Illinois, North Carolina, Texas, and Virginia. So there's one of the reasons why the Business Leaders for Michigan, which is the top CEO organization in the state, has recommended Michigan increase higher education spending by $100 million a year over the next 10 years to catch up with the top 10 states. Because what we've committed to do is become a top 10 state in performance, and we have the Business Leaders of Michigan have put together a performance tracker looking at over 30 metrics in which each of our institutions are compared to their national peers.
Do we know where we stand now?
Each interview, again, it's by institution, and each institution is measured against its national peers. And the funding that our Michigan universities receive, new dollars, is distributed based on your performance. If you're a top 20%, in performance, you receive more. If you are above the national median, you receive just a little less. And if you are showing progress over 3 years, you qualify for funding. If you don't meet any of those three criteria on these various metrics, then there's no money allocated for these institutions.
And if more of the cost burden for higher education ends up on students' shoulders, how do these cuts to higher education affect student access to Michigan University?
Well, that's the issue. It's affordability and access. So, you know, tuition has gone up above the national average in Michigan. No question about that. It's because our state support has been cut by over double the national average. So it's an unsustainable model. It needs to be corrected. What we can show you is that our universities have kept their costs down over the last decade to add inflation, but we haven't kept tuition at inflation. It's gone up probably twice inflation. And the reason being the lack of support from the state.
Are you concerned, though, with the study that you're making a case that there's an awful lot of revenue that is generated by the state's public universities, an awful lot of economic impact, and that legislators won't see the need to increase the funding?
That's a good point. It's a valid point. But again, what I want to point out is if you continue down this road of disinvesting in universities, tuition is going to continue to go up at a point that's unsustainable for the middle and lower class in Michigan. That's the issue here. It's the cost to families and students. We're keeping our cost at inflation. We're keeping our revenue intact. But the mix between the two is significantly out of whack. Example: 30 years ago, the state of Michigan represented 75. The state appropriations represented 75% of a university budget, 25% tuition. Today, it's 20% state appropriations, 80% tuition. Mm.
Now, the legislature has bumped up investment, though, the last couple of years.
They have, and I want to give credit where credit's due. It's in the 12 years I've been at the helm of the President's Council, it's the first time. We received 3% 2 years ago and 2% this past year. But you know, we've lost $1 billion, and we've picked up roughly $50 million. So we've got a long ways to go to make up for a decade of disinvestment.
We're talking with Michael Bolus, Executive Director of the President's Council, State Universities of Michigan. To what extent is right to work at play here? I mean, it was talked about that legislators were threatening cuts to universities if they tried to renegotiate contracts around right to work. What's the legacy of that discussion?
Really, it's insignificant. I mean, again, we got to go back a decade. They've been disinvesting in higher ed for over a decade. I think that was one isolated incident. Right to work really has little bearing on the whole issue since it's that was a small window between the date the bill was passed and immediate effect. But since then, it really hasn't played. It's a non-issue.
Let's go back to this performance-based distribution system that you're advocating. Tell us a little bit more about how that
sure.
would work.
Basically, what we have is a performance tracker system that allows the public to basically look at how each of our institutions compare to their peers. Example, some of the key findings. In 12 of the 15 public universities were above average in producing critical skill degrees and certificates. 7 of the 15 were top 20. 13 of the 15 public universities increased the number of critical skill degrees and certificates they awarded over the last 3 years. What we use this data, the decisions colleges make about their direction is rooted in data. Now that the data exists to track students, all of these can inform decisions and direction by the universities. In terms of controlling costs, in 2011, 7 of the 15 universities had administrative costs that were lower than their peer average. 6 of the 15 saw a drop in these figures, while the rest held administrative cost increases below inflation.
What kind of discussion, Mike, do you anticipate with the legislature about this?
Oh, we think we're getting good traction on both the performance tracker because it shows that we're accountable and we're very transparent. We're leaders in the country in terms of willing to say that you can tie new dollars to performance, and this is really a cutting edge what we've done over the last 2 years.
So would you say you're in sync with the legislature
I think we're in sync with the governor and the legislature on that. Now the question is, okay, how do we become a priority? I mean, the last year, early childhood and transportation were the priorities. So what are the priorities? We want to bump us up in that pecking order in terms of new dollars available and tying it to universities and ultimately to affordability.
Well, looking into the tea leaves here, are you confident that there will be another bump in the next budget?
I'm hopeful. And I'm relatively confident. Well, whether we'll hit the $100 million mark, I'm not sure, but I think we'll see another bump.
Okay. Mike Bolus is the Executive Director of the President's Council, State Universities of Michigan, and we've been talking about higher education funding levels here in Michigan. Thanks, Mike.
My pleasure.
Great actor Peter O'Toole died Saturday at the age of 81, and I suppose if you listen to NPR, you've probably heard that once or twice since Saturday, but who among us has not been moved at least a little bit, some of us a lot, by his performance as T.E. Lawrence? Just the guy for that story. And what a great line in today's USA Today. Apparently Noel Coward, the playwright, quipped after seeing O'Toole floating about the desert in his robes, if you'd been any prettier, it would have been Florence of Arabia. So I'd never heard of that one until this morning. Peter O'Toole, 8 times an Oscar nominee, never a winner, and we have not seen his last movie, by the way. It comes out next year, Catherine of Alexandria. It's called Peter O'Toole. Its current state on WKAR, the Lansing City Council begins its 2014 term in 3 weeks, and for the first time in more than a decade, it will not include at-large Councilman Brian Jeffries. Jeffries served 11 years on the council until he was defeated last month by political newcomer Judy Brown Clark. Brian Jeffries has been in public office in Lansing and Ingham County for some 30 years. He's been a frequent guest on this program. And as he prepares to leave the city council, we're speaking with him again today. Brian, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
You served on the council for 11 years as an at-large representative. You've had a significant number of supporters and some detractors. Why do you think you lost your seat?
You know, it's still trying to think about that a little bit. You know, there seemed to be a disconnect of what we were hearing at the doors. We did a tremendous amount of door-to-door activity during this campaign, and it was very good. The responses were very positive. But I think, in all, there was a very negative campaign that was being run by some shadow groups. We don't know who those were. There was a lot of negative radio ads and very negative
robocalls.
Robocalls, yeah. Mailers. I think that had a lot to do with it as well. And so, you know, it is what it is. The people did what little they got out did speak, and the vote is what it is.
Do you know who funded the robocalls, the radio ads?
No, not directly. And that's, you know, it's interesting that the legislation that's now going through the state that's talking about, let's open this up to some more transparency so we can find out who it is that actually is contributing those kinds of monies to those kinds of activities. I think it's a great thing. I'd love to know. I've got an idea, but it's only speculation.
You were regularly at odds with Mayor Virge Bernero, who criticized you as being overly analytical, mired in the process, versus taking faster action. Was that, at times, over 11 years, an accurate assessment?
You know, I don't believe it was. You know, I think what a council member is supposed to do is, you know, here's how I analyze an issue that will come up. I want to be able to, at the end of the day, when I go through and look at an issue, to be able to go out, say, to a neighborhood group and say, this is the issue that we're dealing with, be able to explain it so they can understand it, and then tell them why I did what I did, whether I voted for or against it, and so that they can come away knowing what was going on. And when I analyze issues, I don't try to slow it down. I don't try to speed it up. I mean, I think the committee work speaks for itself. I was chair of the Development and Planning Committee for many, many years. We never took an issue and buried it in committee so it couldn't come out of committee. We dealt with it mostly, for the most part, on the timelines that were presented to us by the administration. We would get the issue and there would be a timeline saying by this date we need this to happen to it, et cetera. And we were able to meet those deadlines. And those actually, for the most part, were done very quickly, more quickly than I would have liked. But in order to meet what the administration needed, we certainly did that. So, you know, I think in terms of I'm not going to apologize for or go back on the issue of council asking questions. They have that responsibility to do it. It has to be within reason, but we have to understand what it is that we're doing so we can go out to the public and build the public's trust. That's how the, you know, the trust is created, that they understand us and will be able to trust us that we're making good decisions.
Generally, Brian, do you think that other members of the city council take adequate time to analyze the issues?
You know, every council member, it's up to their own, you know, themselves to figure out what they need to do in terms of the amount of information they need and the amount of time they need to take to get that information, to understand it, and to make a decision. You know, I'll leave that to them. I will just say this, though. I think if you look at the work of council, when I first came on in 2002, we were meeting, you know, every Monday night, 50 meetings a week as a council, and then Committee of the Whole would meet on Thursday from about 1 to 5. And there would be a lot of work and time spent on just understanding what's going on in the issue or in the city, particularly as it relates to the budget. we don't put in even a quarter amount at that time.
Does that concern you? I mean, the number of meetings has been cut in half.
Well, the number, it's not necessarily the number of meetings, but having the time to do the work, not only the time, but access to information to be able to analyze that and to make some good decisions. I think with the way things are set up now, we're certainly not getting the information that we need, and certainly it's not timely.
We're talking with Brian Jeffries, formerly of the Lansing City Council. You mentioned your tenure on development and planning. The Red Cedar Renaissance Project mm-hmm. is back in the news. We spoke with Bob Trezise and Joel Ferguson earlier. Did you ever feel the public lost confidence in the project or the city's ability to help make that happen?
You know, it's no. The short answer is no. I think there's a great deal of excitement within the city, particularly on the east side, to get that project going. And there's a lot of, it's not just an economic development project. There's a huge environmental piece to it that needs to be addressed. And I think everybody, you know, just wants to see it happen. And there is a process that you have to go through with developers and particularly a project that is that big to get some outside, you know, help in terms of the scope of the project and financing for the project. And, you know, I'm very excited. I know with the team that's been put together that you're going to have a really tremendous development at that site that I think is really going to bring things together and benefit the city as a whole.
What do you make of Judy Brown Clark and her prospects on the city council?
You know, she's, I hope she's willing to put in the time and the effort on council. She, you know, I think will, you know, we're going to have to watch here very early. You've got one of the first decisions that are going to be made will be leadership decisions, who's going to be the council president, how the committee's going to be divided up. It's going to be interesting to see what her role will be in that. My sense in talking with her throughout the campaign is I think she wants to be in a leadership role. So it's going to be interesting to watch to see where it all comes out.
How did it feel to lose?
Not good. Not good. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I hated to go out in the way that I did, in the sense of all the negativity. It's something that went after, you know, my reputation that I've built up over almost 30 years in public service, and a lot of it was so distorted and so untrue. But I simply didn't have the money to combat that.
What was the biggest untruth in circulation, in your view?
You know, I think just the job killer Jeffries that was out there, that was part of both the radio ads and the huge mailings that went on, the dishonesty that they talked about. You know, that I was not supportive of police and fire and a lot of it. I mean, it just simply was not indicative of and true of what my record actually was. You know, there is a silver lining in the sense that it is a very demanding job in terms of time. I mean, it's a 24/7, 365 days a year type of
job. If you're doing it right.
Yeah,
right.
If you're doing it right. I mean, for example, you get, you know, I'm telling my wife, Ellen, hey, I'm going to go out to the store and get a gallon of milk. I'll be back in 10 minutes. And you're at the store and you're running into four or five people, yeah. And it takes you an hour to get out of there, and you've got four or five issues to work on.
You told us earlier on Current State, earlier this year, that 2014 may be the first time in 7 years the city might not operate under a budget deficit. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I really do. There's the economy is looking much better. The numbers in terms of income taxes and even property tax revenue seems to be going in the right direction, up and instead of down. It looks like the state shared revenues, revenue sharing from the state is at least flat, but it looks like there's going to be some increases made there as well. So on the revenue side, it's looking good. We've done some things to deal on the expense side in terms of consolidation of some services. So I think budget-wise, it's going to be a much better year than we've had, say, over the last 7 years.
Encouraging. Can you point to a single proudest achievement?
You know, not just one. You know, you can talk about the big ones in terms of economic development and point to a building and say, boy, that was pretty cool and sexy. But, you know, I started to run for council, and I ended running for council on the theme of neighborhoods and that they're the heart and soul of the city. And I think the thing that I take away from it the most is having been able to work with the neighborhoods and the individuals. There's such great people in the city of Lansing. And, you know, they're not sexy issues in terms of, you know, trying to get grass cuts or dealing with a drug house. But those issues really make a difference in the quality of life of people in the neighborhoods. And, you know, that's what I look back to and look at in terms of
neighborhood engagement.
Correct.
Any particular regret?
No. You know, I've it's, again, being involved in this for 30 years in public service in one way or another has been, it's a very rewarding, you know, process and you know, I'm not done with it yet. I'm not closing any doors and opportunities, I'm sure, hopefully, will present themselves in the future.
What are your plans? What would you like to, how, if at all, would you like to stay involved?
Well, initially, there's going to be some boards and commissions I'd like to get on and stay involved that way, whether they're public boards or private boards.
Where would you like to go?
In the city or with the county?
Do you feel some particular affinity for a particular responsibility?
Yeah, again, something that if I could, that would, again, look toward neighborhoods, particularly in the city of Lansing. But I'm very open to, you know, looking at other things that might be more regional in scope. But again, I just, you know, I'll start probably looking at that in much more detail after the first of the year.
Taking a little break now?
Well, I'm still cleaning out my office. So.
Oh, okay. What do you think your legacy is going to be? I mean, 11 years on the council, county commissioner.
Yeah.
Hopefully you're not done with your legacy, mm-hmm. is what I just heard you say. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you were to be done now, what do you think your legacy
would
be?
Well, I guess from the city, the takeaway I'd like is that, you know, people to remember that I was really focused on neighborhoods, that focused on quality of life issues, and I worked very hard in terms of economic development to make sure that the development that we created jobs that were going to be retained locally and paid a fair wage to help support working families, you know, put a roof on the head, food on the table, and some clothes on people's mm-hmm. backs. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a really bread and butter kind of approach to things, but I hope that people remember that.
Mm-hmm. Brian Jeffries, formerly of the Lansing City Council. Great talking with you, Brian.
Thanks
for coming in.
Sure.
We appreciate it. Good
appreciate
luck.
It. Take care.
Current state on WKAR, peruse a list of endangered species and you will eventually encounter the Puerto Rican crested toad. Now at Lansing's Potter Park Zoo, officials are involved in a project to help save that toad from extinction. The Puerto Rican crested toad is a native species of toad that cannot be found anywhere else. We welcome Potter Park Zoo veterinarian Dr. Tara Harrison and zookeeper Sarah Pechtel, who have both assisted in the effort to raise tadpoles and recently shipped 26,000 to Puerto Rico. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
And we want to learn more about this effort involving this Puerto Rican crested toad. Briefly describe for us this animal. What do they look like?
They range from 2 inches to 5 inches. They're not terribly exciting. They have sort of a goldish-brown skin. It's warty. They're called a crested toad because they have crested ridges around their eyes, the little upturned snout. They're really difficult to see, actually, in the wild, and they can be incredibly difficult to see in a zoo exhibit as well. So,
5-inch toad I find rather exciting, to tell you the truth, especially when I encounter one unexpectedly. Why are they endangered?
They're primarily endangered due to habitat loss, and then there's also an invasive species of a toad that's, you know, competing for their space, their resources, things like that. So it's a little different than other amphibians where chytrid fungus has caused the decline. This one, it's more habitat destruction.
Okay, and it's an island, so you obviously have you have a built-in limit to begin with.
That's correct.
Geographically, how did Potter Park Zoo get involved, and why did the zoo want to get involved?
We got involved actually back in 2006, and we joined the breeding program in 2008. I think a call went out looking for other zoos who are willing to participate. It's a fairly intensive process. Breeding these toads, and not every zoo is capable of it, has the resources or the time or the staffing to do it. So we wanted to get involved. They're the first, they were the first amphibian species survival plan, and they're really cool. We wanted to get involved in it. So I think it was just sort of we discussed it with Dr. Tara that, you know, it seemed like a great project for Potter Park to be involved in. So
is the zoo paid for this work?
The zoo's not paid for this work. We provide the funds for doing this program, but it's part of being with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. We participate in these species survival plans or these breeding programs, and we had the time and the staff and the facilities to be able to do it, and we thought that it would be a great program for us to be involved in. And also, it's our only program where we're breeding for release into the wild, so we were very excited about that part of the program.
You are working alongside institutions in Detroit, Buffalo, Nashville, and Toronto. Without getting too clinical, what's involved in breeding toads?
It's a funny, long process. Obviously, we can't ever fully replicate their breeding situation in the wild. The whole process prior to breeding takes about 39 days. We fast the toads so that when they're going into breeding, or into hibernation rather, there's no food in their systems to cause any problems. Over the course of 3 days, we cool them down to 66 degrees. And then they spend about 27 days hibernating. We check on them. We make sure that they're doing good, that they're, you know, healthy and stuff. At the end of that, we bring them out of hibernation. We raise them to 82 degrees over the course of 3 days. They then get a reprieve, 5 days of getting to eat. They get a fungal bath to prevent any diseases getting passed on to their tadpoles. Once that's all done, then it's actually time to breed. We get to we don't get to pick which toads breed. That's SSP's job. They tell us we want these genetics to come through. And then from
SSP?
There, Species Survival Plan.
Okay.
So the people who are in charge of the whole breeding process, they go in a rain tank. They get to listen to toad calls. We give them hormone shots, and we cross our fingers, and we hope that everybody likes everybody else, and it all works out. Interestingly enough, last year was our most successful year, and we had thunderstorms during the course of breeding, which probably really helped the toads feel more at home.
How interesting. You can't replicate a thunderstorm in your laboratory, then.
We do the best that we can.
It helped when the weather cooperated. How interesting.
With the raining constantly and the toad calls 24 hours, it seems like it's an environment that they should like.
Tell us about shipping thousands of tadpoles to Puerto Rico. How is that done?
It's a very complicated process where you first off have to catch them all, and they're very active, very tiny, swimming all around. So after we catch them all, we put them in a baggie, basically, and then put oxygen in the bag with them, seal it, put it in a styrofoam box, and then they get to fly in an airplane off to Puerto Rico.
And other zoos are breeding tadpoles as well, some of these other locations we mentioned?
We all breed at the same time, so we coordinate the hibernation period, the breeding period, and the shipping, so they're all flying on airplanes at the same time from different locations to the same location.
All the tadpoles.
Why does it have to be so precise?
Well, this past year we had some issues with shipping, and the breeding pond, or the pond that the tadpoles go to, is 3 hours away from the airport. And when you're receiving thousands of tadpoles, you don't want to be driving back and forth and back and forth. So it's much easier for the Puerto Rican staff, the people who are involved from their DNR and stuff.
Logistics.
Yes,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Exactly.
What does it cost? I know Lansing sent 26,000 tadpoles to Puerto Rico last month, correct?
Yes. I don't know exactly what the cost is.
But you've got how many people involved in the project? How many people's hands are actually on this?
I mean,
Lansing.
For us, I mean, there's two or three of us who do all the breeding. That staff's involved for, you know, making sure everybody's healthy before they get sent and healthy before they breed.
There's probably at least seven staff that are involved at some point in the process, either before, during, or after for doing that. So it's one of those things that it's hard to figure out exactly the cost because not all of us are involved in as much. Sarah obviously is involved a whole lot more than I am, but I'm involved, you know, making sure they're all healthy and things like that. And I have to sign the health certificate for them to be able to go. And but it's one of those things that's expected of us as an AZA or the Association of Zoos and Aquarium Zoo to participate in programs like this. So we just do that because it's important to us to help preserve and conserve this species.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Potter Park Zoo veterinarian Dr. Tara Harrison and zookeeper Sarah Pechtel about their efforts to help save the Puerto Rican crested toad. Here, there's quite an effort underway at the Lansing Potter Park Zoo to help do that. Once they're released into the wild, do we know their survival rate? Do we know if they're reproducing as hoped?
They're starting to see tadpoles that had been released coming back as toads. The numbers are hard to come by. Tadpoles naturally have a fairly high mortality rate to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe they do any radio tracking or anything like that in Puerto Rico currently. So, but they are starting to see toads returning to the ponds they morphed out of as tadpoles. But numbers-wise, I don't think they have a good idea yet in terms of what sort of return we're getting.
How it's working.
Yeah.
Okay. Can visitors to the Potter Park Zoo see a Puerto Rican crested toad? Is this an animal that's on display there?
We do have an exhibit for it in our Bird and Reptile House building, so you can be able to see them.
And the crested part, does that mean they have, like, little horns on the top of their head?
Ridges.
Is that what that means? Ridges.
Ridges.
They have sort of like an upturned nose as well. But
And remind us what amphibians are. Amphibians have a pretty, they're not reptiles. We all learned this in seventh grade biology, whatever it is. What is an amphibian? What is a reptile?
Well, amphibians are cold-blooded, just like reptiles. So basically the difference from the reptiles is that amphibians tend to spend either part of or more of their life in water compared to most reptiles. They also have other various, you know, different adaptations. They
permeable
can breathe
skin.
Through their skin.
Yeah. Okay.
And they can absorb things through their skin. So medicines or things on your hands, if you handle them, they can get absorbed through their skin too. So that's probably another major difference is that reptiles don't absorb as much through their skin.
Potter Park Zoo veterinarian Dr. Tara Harrison and zookeeper Sarah Pechtel, thanks to both of you for helping us understand the project to save the Puerto Rican crested toad from extinction going on here in Lansing. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Current State for Monday. Coming up tomorrow, we take a look at the latest Kids Count report from the Michigan League for Public Policy. The executive director of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.